Heraclius asked for his, people in his court, if they had anybody of the Arabs, those people who have sent this letter, in the area. And Abu Sufyan, who that time was still a pagan, was on a trade trip to this area of Palestine. So they brought Abu Sufyan, and Abu Sufyan and his comrades, and they put Abu Sufyan in the front, and they put his comrades behind him so that he would not see them. And Heraclius told his interpreter that he's going to ask Abu Sufyan some questions concerning Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And if he was to lie, Abu Sufyan, then his people behind him should make a gesture that he's lying. But of course, Abu Sufyan would not know that because they were behind him. And so then he asked him those strange questions, like, what do you know of this man? What is his message? Was he a king before you? Was he a descendant of a king? These questions, which are signs of the prophethood, that that the Christian ruler knew because he knew how the prophets were from his books, because he was also a scholar of his religion. And then Heraclius, the king of Rome, testified that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was truly the messenger of Allah. And he said that he feared that it would not come shortly a day when he would take over the lands which they were in. Palestine. This land given to the Prophet Abraham. And we know from the Sirah, Heraclius then tried to convince the Christians to accept Islam. So he called them the next day. He called his bishops and his leaders, his political leaders, his military leaders, and they filled up the church, and he locked the doors. And he said, what would if I tell you that I'm going to become a Muslim? What would you say? And they started to get so angry, they wanted to flee out of the thing. And then he said, no, I was just testing your obedience. I wasn't meaning that. So he gave up. He gave up the kingdom of the hereafter for his earthly kingdom in this world. And he decided that he was going to then fight the Muslims. And he sent out his army of 100,000 people in the Battle of Mu'tah, where the Prophet's companions fought, and then the battles after Prophet's death occurred when they defeated the armies of Heraclius and took, in the time of Umar al-Khattab, Jerusalem and these lands to return to Palestine. But the point is that if you look at Genesis, you can see that when they said in this passage that the covenant was to be given to Abraham and his seed, an everlasting covenant until the day of judgment, and the sign of the covenant is for a circumcised people, we are that circumcised people. And even our women are circumcised. Or many countries, Muslim women circumcised. And it's from the practice of the Prophet ﷺ's generation that women would circumcise. Not all the women. It's not something which is required like for men. But it's something from Islam. So it's not even that our men are circumcised, but also that our women are also, or many of our women, or some of our women are also circumcised. Now, we know that the Jews and Christians, of course, twist all these prophecies that are found in the Old Testament and New Testament that prove the Prophet of Allah, and twist all these historical incidents and facts. But let us continue with our discussion of what we find the Jews and Christians believing in Genesis. Okay. So as we find in the 15th chapter of Genesis, that the text of the Torah tells us what is this land that has been given to Abraham and his descendants. It says, unto thy seed, meaning Abraham's seed, his descendants, have I given this land from the river of Egypt, which is the Nile, unto the great river, the river of Euphrates, or the river Euphrates, which is in Iraq. So here the land is not just that land of Canaan, which is given in the beginning, but it's given from the Nile to the Euphrates, from Egypt to Iraq. This is all supposed to be from this. And it's said that in the Israeli flag, for those of you who know, it has those two blue stripes, and then it has the Star of David in between. These two blue stripes are supposed to represent the two rivers. The river is Nile and the river is Euphrates. And the Jewish army, that this is their line between these two rivers, based upon this text in Genesis. All right, then after this we find Abraham dies, in the Torah it tells about his death and so forth, and then it brings us to his grandson, Jacob, Yaqub, who is known as also Israel, Israel. So we find that Jacob leaves Beersheba, and he falls asleep in between Beersheba and Haran, which is in the land of Palestine, And in a dream it says that Allah comes to Jacob and says, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the guide of Isaac. The God of Isaac, because Abraham is his grandfather and Isaac is his father, two prophets of Allah. A land wherein thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. And thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, what is specific about this? This prophecy which we gave to Abraham, I mean, you can say by, you know, that it could have gone to any of Abraham's descendants, or to all of his descendants, in the sense that it was given to Abraham, and Abraham had more than one descendant. But here, it specifically is given to whom? To Jacob, to the prophet Ya'qub, alayhi salam, and his descendants. So in other words, it is an exclusion to the other branch of Abraham, the Arabs, or Ismail, from which the prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam came from. But this text is a lie, because look what it says. It says that thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. In other words, the children of Israel shall be so numerous as the dust of the earth. And thy seed shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north, to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, let us look at that. Are the Jews of such numbers that they are like the dust of the earth? No. They are the most fewest of people in the world. And also, the majority of the Jews are not from the children of Israel. The majority of the Jews are either people who have become Jewish, but were not themselves from the children descendants of Israel. Like the Eastern European Jewry, who are a bunch of people which were known as the Khazars. People in the Caucasus Mountains, you know, this area of Shishan and so forth, whole large numbers of them became Jewish at one time. Why? Because they were being crushed. They were a pagan people. They were being crushed by two forces. The Muslims were coming from the south, and the Christians from the north, from Moscow. And so, therefore, they didn't want to become Muslims because they liked to drink wine. And they didn't want to become Christians because if they became Christians, the Muslims would wage jihad against them, because this is the Muslims' enemy. They said, okay, the best thing to do is become Jews. And so then these Jews, you have Eastern European Jewry, which is spread now throughout Eastern Europe and now all settled in Palestine and so forth. The majority of these people are not the children of, descendants of the children of Israel. Likewise, the Falasha Jew in Ethiopia. Can we say that the Falasha Jew also in Ethiopia is also a descendant of the children of Israel? And the Arab Jew, the Jew of Morocco and Yemen and Iraq and so forth, these are also descendants of the prophet Isaac. So even if you were to extract all these children of Israel from the Jews, how many true Jews left on the earth are also children of Israel? This shows that this prophecy was never intended for Isaac. But they changed their books. And the prophecy is for the children of Ismail, the Arabs, the Ummah of Muhammad ﷺ, because they are become like the dust of the earth. And their families have mixed. You find now in Iran, among the Persian people, you find people who are of Arab stock, who were originally Arab people who came there with Islam. In Afghanistan, you find people who are originally from Arab descent. In China, you find people who are originally from Arab descent. In Turkey, in Africa. I mean, you can go into some places of, you know, West Africa, where you find the descendants of Umar ibn al-Khattab. And yet they appear just like the African people. How come? Because when the Sahaba spread and the Arabs spread with Islam, they went throughout all the earth and they mixed with the peoples. And so therefore, and it's also through the children of Ismail alayhi salam, when they accepted at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam, that all the peoples of the earth were blessed, as we discussed earlier. So, this is what the Jewish belief is based upon. The Jewish belief is based upon these prophecies, which they have misinterpreted and corrupted, to say that they are the inheritors of the earth. And that also this lie which they have attributed to Noah, that Noah became drunken, and that therefore the other peoples of the earth are to be their servants and slaves, to work for their ends. Okay, now comes the question, what about the Christians? Somebody might say, well, these are all talking concerning the Jews in the Old Testament. Why are the Christians involved? Let us now investigate the issue of the Christians. Remember, I said to you in the beginning, and I'm sure all of you know, because this is basically a Christian country, you might say, that the Christian book, the Bible, what they call the Holy Bible, is divided into two parts, two testaments, an Old Testament and a New Testament. And it is in the Old Testament that these prophecies occur, which they believe in. So any Christian, when he opens up his Holy Bible, the first thing he's going to read are these prophecies, because he sees himself as an extension of that. Now, somebody might say that, for instance, that the Christians have been known throughout history, I mean, even until recent times, like in Germany in World War II, to persecute the Jews. So how is it that they are standing side by side with the Jews? This is what we'd like to investigate now. We all know that all three religions, the Jews, Christians, and Muslims, believe that the final battle of history will occur, and in that final battle of history, its religion would become victorious over the earth, and all other religions will be wiped out. And that the leader of this great final battle will be a leader which is not like other leaders which we are used to, but he will be a special leader. He will be divinely supported and aided. And that his name is the Messiah, Al-Messiah. And so therefore, as Ibn al-Qayyim says, the three nations all await an expected one who will come forth from the end of time. All three groups of people wait this expected one. For each religion was promised this individual. In each scripture you find this. And the Muslims await, of course, for the return of Isa ibn Maryam, who, as the Prophet ﷺ has told us, will be a Muslim ruler, judging by the Quran and the Sunnah, and he will break the cross, meaning put an end to Christianity, and he will not accept the jizya, meaning people will either become Muslim or they'll be put to the sword. And he will exterminate the pig, which the Christians have made lawful for themselves. And we also know that during his time, he will lead the Muslim forces who will fight a battle against the Antichrist, a Dajjal, who will have amongst his followers 70,000 Jews from the city of Isfahan. And that Isa ibn Maryam will kill the Messiah Dajjal with his spear, his javelin, and he will show his blood to the Muslims. And then the Jews will flee when they see that their king has fallen, and they will hide behind rock and tree, and rock and tree will say, "O Muslim, O Abdullah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him." This is what the Muslims believe. And the Christians believe that the Messiah will come down, Jesus the Son of Mary, and he will exterminate all the people of Canaan, the Muslims in other words, and the Jews in the Battle of Armageddon. And the Jews believe, according to the Talmud, that when the Messiah comes, who they do not believe is Isa ibn Maryam, he will come and he will exterminate all the Christians and the Muslims. So each religion is waiting for the Messiah to come. The Muslims and the Christians are in agreement to his identity, that it's Jesus the Son of Mary. But they are disagreement as to who is Isa ibn Maryam. Christians believing that he is the Son of Allah, and that he is, Muslims believing that he is the Prophet of Allah. And the Muslims and Christians are in agreement that the Messiah will exterminate the Antichrist, if you call it in English, or Dajjal of the Jews, the kings of the Jews. We're in agreement to this. And so for based upon this, the future battle, what's going to happen is going to be a battle between two messiahs. One of them, the Antichrist, whom the Jews believe in and call, listen to this very carefully, they call him, according to the Bible, he is known as the Prince of Peace. And this is what? The era of peace, they say. And they prepare for his arrival. They don't call him the Antichrist. I mean, even though the Muslims and the Christians believe that when the King of the Jews comes, he will be the Antichrist, the Jews do not believe he's the Antichrist. They believe he's the true Messiah. And the other one, the other Messiah who will engage in the battle, is the true Messiah, the son of Mary, alayhi salam, who the Muslims and Christians both believe will descend from the heavens and return to earth. Now, the Jews and Christians agree that this expected Messiah will be from the children of Israel. I mean, they're in agreement that he will be a descendant of the children of Israel. And the Muslims also agree that because Isa ibn Maryam was from Bani Israel. And the Christians and Jews believe that he will descend among the children of Israel. This is what we do not we disbelieve in. We believe that when Isa comes down, alayhi salam, he will not come down among the children of Israel, but he will come among the ranks of the Muslims as they pray Salat al-Fajr, as they are preparing for Salat al-Fajr. The Jews and Christians believe that he will come down and descend where? Among the children of Israel. And therefore, they believe that the children of Israel will be his soldiers and his supporters, and that the capital of Jesus will be Jerusalem. This is what the Christians and Jews believe. And they also believe that his return will come at the beginning of a millennium, at the beginning of 1,000 years. Okay. So they believe that he will come amongst the children of Israel, and they believe that he will come at the beginning of 1,000 years, at the turn of a millennium, and that the children of Israel will be his soldiers and his supporters. What do they base this belief upon? Well, they base it upon some of the interpretations that they have of the revelation of St. John the Divine, which is the last one of the last books of the New Testament. You know, the New Testament has many books in it, right? And one of the books is called the Book of Revelation, where they say that John, who they claim is one of the Hawariyun, one of the apostles of Jesus, you know, disciples of Jesus, that he had a dream where Jesus came to him and said, this is what is going to happen in the future. And based upon this interpretation, they say they have these ideas. And they also base it upon the dreams of certain of their monks, of their religious leaders and their rabbis, and the visions of some soothsayers, like Nostradamus. They also interpret events based upon this. And therefore, before the Gulf War, 5 years ago in 1990, when the Christians came to the lands of the Muslims and the war was going to come, the level of intensity of faith in the return of Jesus reached very high proportions in America and in Europe and elsewhere among the Christians. Because some of them thought that this battle of the Gulf War was the beginning of the Battle of Armageddon, and that Jesus was going to come any moment. And so therefore, as we now approach the end of this 1,000 years, the second millennium, and we start now the third millennium, the year 2000, it's just only, how many years away? Just 3.5 or 4 years away. We find that two dreams converge where this bogus promise, this bogus interpretation of the covenant of God given to Abraham comes about. The first is the Christian dream, a dream for 2,000 years now, that the Messiah, Jesus, the son of Mary, will return, descend back to earth, and in the battle of Armageddon, as we shall express, will kill the Jews and Muslims and all those who don't follow the religion. And the Jewish dream, which they've had now for 5,000 years, that their king will come among the descendants of David, who will kill the Christians and Muslims and make humanity slaves for the sake of Israel. And this king is none other than the Antichrist, as we know. And it was from this standpoint that the Jews and the Christians agreed that they have to create the state of Israel and put all the Jews back in the state of Israel in order to prepare for the return of the Messiah, according to each interpretation. Because each group is waiting a Messiah. And so therefore, even though logically it would seem that in this time period, Muslims and Christians should be in unity and working together to fight the Jews, because we all agree, Muslims and Christians, that the true Messiah is Jesus, the son of Mary. And we all agree that the Messiah of the Jews is the false Messiah, the Antichrist, who the Muslims would fight. So a logical review would mean that in this period of time, the Christians should be helping the Muslims fighting the Jews. And that a war, an unrelentless war, would occur between the Christians and the Jews, because in preparation for that final battle between the two Messiahs. But what has happened? Are the Christians on the side of the Muslims in this issue? They're on the side of the Jews. What is this indicative of? This shows us the deeply rooted hate the Christians have, where they are willing to give up all their monetary benefits that they can gain. As one person said 15, 20 years ago, they're willing to give up all the oil of OPEC for a bunch of oranges that come out of Israel. They're willing to give up all these monetary benefits, all this also the religious benefits, which they, the religious necessities of the religious beliefs, in order to work with the Jews. And so therefore, they came up with this idea. Let's not discuss the details of how the Messiah is going to come back. What we should do now is just prepare for his coming, and then when Jesus comes back, or when not Jesus, the Messiah comes back, we'll see. If he's the Messiah of the Jews, we all become Jews. If he's the Messiah of the Christians, then you all will become Christians or face the sword. And so therefore, the Jews and the Christians came together and said, it's in our interest for us to leave this issue hanging as to his identity and work at putting the Jews back in the state of Israel, the land of Palestine, to prepare for the coming of the Messiah and work against their common enemy. Who? The Muslims. And therefore, we find that Jews and Christians are standing side by side by, for the first time in history, for this matter. Throughout history, Christians have been persecuting Jews. And so therefore, it is not surprising why we find the Jews and Christians standing side by side if we look at this issue in this way. But what is surprising is that why would the Muslim, the Arab in particular, run behind these Jews and Christians? And so therefore, let us review three events of this century. Now, we know that at the beginning of this century, at the year 1900, like in the end of the 1800s, 1880s and 1890s, the Christians said, well, if Jesus is to come back, if he doesn't come back at the beginning of this last century, meaning in the year 1900, he's going to come back at the end of the 1990s, in the year 2000. And so therefore, in the end of the 1800s, there was a great movement for the return of Jesus. Among one of these groups that occurred during this time were the Jehovah Witnesses, which thought that Jesus was going to come back in the first part of this century. And so therefore, a conspiracy to put the Jews in the state of Israel and to prepare for the Messiah to create in Israel occurred. The first event was World War I, which among its aims and consequences was that the Ottoman state, the Khilafah, would be dismembered, and that they would put an end to this Khilafah, which even though the Khilafah at that time, I mean by the time of World War I, was basically figurative in meaning, and most of the Muslim lands were under the rules of either direct or indirect rule of the colonies to the Western powers, and the Khilafah had reached certain weakness, which was, I mean, was unable to really last much longer. However, though, it resembled a symbol in the minds of Muslims and Muslim unity. And it was just that psychological symbol. So this was one of their aims. And in fact, in the papers, if you go to any library, especially for those brothers in college, you can open up your old papers from the year 1914, 1915, 1916, these years of World War I, and look at the headline written in like the London Times concerning World War I and the what they were saying about how the Khilafah must end. This is, I mean, in the newspapers you'll find. And the slogan in England in those days was, the Turk must go. In other words, the Uthmani Khilafah must come out, must go, must put to an end. So they used to say, the Turk must go. This was the war slogan of World War I, because the Uthmanis were Turkish, as we all know. And also, part of the aims, or one of the results of World War I, was the declaration that the Jews had a right to establish a homeland in Israel, what was known as the Balfour Declaration. And that is because when the final Uthmani Khalifa, Sultan Abdul Hamid, refused to accept the Jewish bride by Theodore Herzl in the end of the 1800s, Theodore Herzl came to the Uthmanis and said, listen, we'll buy from you Palestine. Give you all the gold you want. Give us Palestine. So when he refused, they decided to remove the Uthmani Khilafa, and Balfour, Lord Balfour here, who was the foreign minister, and who was a fanatical evangelical, as we will see, came out with his declaration that the Jews have a right to establish a homeland, a national home in Palestine. Now, what was the position of the Muslims during this time? The Muslims, well, the Muslims decided to follow Lawrence of Arabia, galloping in the desert of Arabia, to fight their brethren, the Uthmanis, the Turks, and through the armies of the Arabs, they allowed the British to take over Palestine and take over Syria and take over Iraq by fighting, the Muslims being turned to fight against the Uthmanis. And when Lord Allenby, the general of the British forces in the Middle East, entered into Jerusalem, he went to Mount of Olives, which is a hill in Jerusalem where Jesus gave his Sermon on the Mount, the very famous chuppah, which is in the Testament and so forth. And he planted his flag on the Mount of Olives, the Union Jack, and said, only now have the Crusades come to an end. Only now the Crusades have come to an end. What was occurred during this time? Then we find that also Woodrow Wilson, the American president, comes up with the idea of a League of Nations where they would rule these different lands of the Muslim world, and they split it up into small countries, and we have now the nationalism which we are suffering from. What was the second event that occurred this century? Second major event was World War II. And World War II occurred also a number of matters. In World War II, we have find that Nazism, which the Germans adopted, and which was a direct challenge to the Jewish Zionism, was defeated. And communism, Russian communism, was glorified because the Russians were one of the allies. A state which was established by the Jews, because most of the founders of communism were Jews, like Marx and Lenin and Engels, and which glorifies Jewish beliefs. Communism has many beliefs which are drawn from Judaism. And again, the Muslims were deceived by the promises of the West and returned to fighting on the side and becoming soldiers for the West. Indeed, one fatwa was given that the British, the British at that time, of course, were ruling India. It was before India was partitioned and had its independence. And the British were also ruling Egypt, because before Egypt's independence. And the Germans were also in Africa. And a great battle occurred called the Battle of Al-Alamein, where the Germans fought the British in Egypt. Okay. Now, the British needed soldiers, so they brought many Muslims from India to fight in their ranks. And they also brought with them shiuch, to give them a fatwa that to fight the Germans was, what? Jihad in the path of Allah. And so again, the Muslims were duped and confused into believing that to fight the Germans was jihad in the path of Allah. Not to say, this does not mean, that to fight with the Germans is jihad. But the point is that this is a war between Christian powers. What does it have to do with the Muslims being on any side, and much less being jihad in the path of Allah? And then, of course, we find afterwards, after the end or before the conclusion of World War II, we find the Declaration of the United Nations and its charter in San Francisco, and the slogan that the right of each people to have self-determination and the rights of every people to have the freedoms of human rights, all these slogans which the West still mimics today, and through it control the populations of the earth through these hypocritical slogans. What was the third event that happened this century? Third event happened just a few years ago, in the end of the 80s, with the collapse of communism, and what was entitled the International Reconciliation between the Russians and the Americans. You know, after World War II, the world was divided into two camps of people. The Eastern Bloc, which was based upon a dictatorial communism, and they had satellites throughout the world, countries which followed them, and you had the Western Bloc, which is based upon liberalism and secularism, the West, led by America. And it existed between both blocs, something which was called a Cold War, which at times became real war, and they fought in many different places around the world. You had the crisis in Cuba in the 60s. You had the battles in Angola. You had the Vietnam conflict. You had the Middle East conflict. You had the battle in Afghanistan. These were all different battles that occurred between these people, and Korea before that in the 50s, between these two blocs in different parts of the world. But with the collapse of communism, when it was decided that communism was to come to an end, that the role for communism was to come to an end, communism, the Christians, quickly, all of a sudden, returned back to the old Western Christian camp. And the international reconciliation occurred when the first meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev in Malta in the 80s. And since that time, what has happened? What was the old Eastern Bloc, the Russians, who are now Orthodox Christians, all of a sudden, overnight, become Orthodox Christians, and the West have become a single stick to clobber the Muslims. And therefore you find now an issue which is happening this day in Chechnya, where 8 years ago or less, when the Russians were fighting the Muslims in Afghanistan, before the international reconciliation, before the New World Order, the American government, the Europeans, were assisting the Mujahideen to fight the Russians. And now in Chechnya, the West, through the IMF, is giving billions of dollars in loans, interest-free loans or low-interest loans, extended loans, to the Russians, in other words, in order to actually finance the war against the Muslims in the Caucasus. And so therefore, they have become now a single stick to clobber the Muslims. And the same thing we saw in Bosnia, where the Russians were sending volunteers to fight with the Serbians. They were sending oil and resources and money to the Serbians, and yet the West was holding the hands of the Muslims so the Muslims could not aid their brethren in Bosnia. And the slaughter that occurred in Bosnia is well known. So this mass has ended, and people now have accepted this idea of a one world, new world order, a one unified world, a single government, with the West leading, with American control and dominance over the world. And what has happened? The peace process has grown out of this. And so you have now this big heavy stick to smash the head of any Muslim who's going to stand up. And the doors of, after the international reconciliation, the Jews of Eastern Europe, which was the greatest Jewish population after America, all migrated, all these Russian Jews and Eastern European Jewry came to Israel to become soldiers and indoctrinated for the battle against the Muslims. And the Jewish finance houses of New York and London and elsewhere to control the wealth of the Muslims, especially the oil wealth, through the peace process, by which the Arabs and the Muslims will become, in the third world, slave laborers for the Jewish finance houses and the Jewish economy, world-driven economy of Western companies and so forth. This is exactly what's happening now. Go to Malaysia, go to Bangladesh. You find these massive Western companies now moving to these lands. Why? Because they want to help Muslim economies? No, because they want your cheap labor. So you go now to Bangladesh, you go down to Malaysia, perhaps even the sneakers that most of you brothers are wearing were produced in Malaysia and Indonesia, where you find Muslim women working in slave conditions, 12, 14, 16 hours a day, for maybe less than a dollar a day, to make shoes, which they make the money off, and then they sell back to us, as we are the consumers. We are their laborers. We toil all day long to produce the product for them, and then they take that product and sell it back to us again. Now, so in order to facilitate the world conditions, it's necessary for the West, it was necessary for them to destroy any single military might in the Islamic world. And so therefore the Gulf War occurred. Not because the Gulf War occurred because the Iraqi government, a unbelieving apostate government, is going to give victory to Islam. But the military might which was developed there might one day be inherited by the Muslims. I mean, one day it's conceivable that the Muslims would change the situation in Iraq, and then all that military might and expertise and technological expertise, right, would be Muslim powers. Because those people, even though now they're being ruled by an unbelieving regime, and it's a regime which is a butcher regime and so forth, but nonetheless, the people in their essence are Muslims. We saw this in Bosnia. The Bosnians were underneath communist rule for, 50, 60, 70 years. They knew nothing of Islam. I mean, Bosnians were just Muslims because they were just Muslims, that's all. His name was Muhammad instead of his name being, I don't know what Bosnian name is, his Serb name. Harris or whatever. Not a Harris, no, Mikhailovich or something like that, you know. So the point is that all his name was, you know, Mohammedovich instead of Mikhailovich or something like that. That's why he was a Muslim. And so when the Serbs were killing them, they had no idea why they were being killed. They said, well, you're our neighbors and we marry you, we all drink beer together, what's the big deal? But what happened was in a few years, the Bosnians started to return to Islam. You now find in Sarajevo and different cities in Bosnia, women wearing hijab, some even women wearing niqab. So the Muslim peoples, even though they are ignorant of their religion, when they have the opportunity to be taught, a dawah to be given to them, they return unto Allah. There is still good present in the hearts of the Muslims. They just need somebody to go out there and preach to them and to remove these forces and these ideas away from them so that you can grow and let them develop. And so therefore the fear of the West was, even though they had built the armies of Iraq, that it would one day be inherited by the Muslims. And so therefore they had to destroy it. And this is what's happening throughout the Islamic world. No Muslim country is allowed to develop to the level where it might become a powerful nation, or it might in the future become a land. In Pakistan, when Zia al-Haq, I mean, with all his faults and all his, you know, his matters which we would disagree with, right? But because he had an Islamic sort of sense to him, okay? Because he had an Islamic spirit in him, they assassinated him. And when they assassinated him, they were willing to assassinate the American ambassador on the airplane with them. And they switched the situation in Pakistan, as Pakistan was supporting the Muslims, and there was a growth in Pakistan towards implementing the Sharia, was all of a sudden switched, and who has now taken over? Who is the model of Islamic, you know, sisterhood or motherhood, I don't know what, but I mean, has come about. So see, the point is that the West will not allow any Muslim country to reach a level of development. Even though the people might be secularists or so forth, in the fear that in one day, the Muslims might then, the Dawah might spread and take over the resources. So they'll engage it in civil war, they'll engage it in a war they'll start, they will cause it some sort of problem in order that the Muslims will never reach that level. Not that these regimes themselves will carry the battle of Islam, but in the fear that one day they will inherit, the Muslims of that land will inherit that. Most of the Muslim population in the world today is under 21 years old. Under 21 years old. The population in Algeria now, for instance, okay, it said that more than 60% of the people in Algeria are under 16 years old. More than 60%. If more than 60% of a country is under 16 years old, if you had Islamic schools, within one generation, those will be the Muslims that you need. But if a bunch of 16 years old kids are living in circumstances of civil war, living in circumstances of confusion and, you know, and displacement and poverty, where people cannot go to school and not learn and know there's no dawah, and people are engaged in fighting and killing each other, how can you imagine that an ummah will come about of that? You will not have an ummah. You will have a generation of lost people, lost youth, who when they are in their 20s and 30s will know nothing but killing. They will know nothing of Islam. They will not be capable of doing anything. They will be uneducated either in worldly or religious matters. Like in Somalia. Somalia has a very young population. If you look at the demographics, take the United Nations statistics, is very young. But the Somalis cannot be imagined that at this time, you know, that this generation will be able to do anything, because it's a lost generation. They know only clan warfare and killing and so forth. Not one of them has sat down in school for one day to learn something. So it's a lost cause. And so this is what is happening. Because in one generation, the Islamic world can change if there are schools, if there's dawah. Because the population of the Islamic world is extremely young. And it said, I think the latest thing I read, that the majority, maybe more than 50% of the whole Islamic world is under than 21 years old. And of those 1 billion Muslims, it said that maybe more than 50% is under 21. Do you see how the youth, you could change a generation within 30 years, those youth could become the parents of a new generation, which would be upon Islam. But it's important then, therefore, that these youth never reach their potential. That they're diverted from that by one way or the other. Either corrupted into living lives where the role model is Michael Jackson and Madonna, or caught into starvation and displacement, or caught into an issue of warfare and civil unrest, or caught to follow all these strange and sects and so forth, and, you know, deviant groups like Sufis and Shias and so forth. All to set them off from the path of Allah. Now, when the Messiah descends, what do the three groups, going back, that was a sort of long ago, diversion, what will be the humanity's future when the Messiah descends? All three religions agree that when the Messiah descends, and after annihilating his enemies, humanity will live under a single world government. This is the first issue of substance. And the second issue of substance is that peace will prevail throughout the world. And so under the shade of this one government, there will be no need for war between nations and peoples. Indeed, the world will no longer need armies and weapons. And so therefore, it is from this concept that the Jews and Christians have decided to manipulate to set up this new world order. And if you go to the United Nations building in New York City, and you look at the cornerstone, you'll find something very strange there. You'll find a passage from Isaiah concerning the return of Messiah, and when he returns, you know, people will beat their swords into plowshares, and there will be no more war, and peace will be throughout the earth. It is this idea that has propelled them to set up this new world order. And this is how the Americans have decided to manipulate the issue. Because if there's going to be a single world government where all nations are going to live under a single ruler, then why not let it be an American ruler? And so here American opportunism enters into the picture. Because the American ruler, what he's going to now use, and he's going to now manipulate his resources to serve the Jewish aims, he has to raise the flag of American nationalism high in order to do that. So now, how much time do we have for this session?
No problem.
Okay. So now let us investigate in the details after we've set now the theoretical basis of the beliefs or the ideological framework for these beliefs. Let us now investigate how was this bogus promise, how was this bogus covenant set up regarding the Christians and the Jews. So we said earlier that the Christians believe that at the conclusion of 1,000 years, the Messiah will return and will rule the earth for 1,000 years. And upon the basis of this belief, their hopes unified and their sights were directed to the end of the first millennium. And if you look at any book of European history, you'll find in the year 1000 a lot of strange things happened. All these Europeans started to leave their homes and their villages and go to the mountains and sit there waiting for Jesus to come back, because they felt that he was going to come back after 1,000 years. Well, they sat there for a while, got cold and hungry, and they realized he wasn't coming back. So they said, okay, back into our homes, let's wait for another 1,000 years. So even though the issue died out in the reality of the day-to-day affairs, the dream and the hope still remained alive in their hearts and in their minds, that at the end of 1,000 years, Asa will come back. And it was prior to the beginning of this century, that is near the year 1900, that these claims began anew. The Christians believed that if Jesus wasn't going to appear at the beginning of the 20th century, in the 1900s, then he must appear at the year 2000. And since his appearance will be in his homeland, it was necessary to prepare the ground for his coming by restoring all the children of Israel, all the Jews, to the land of Palestine, which upon which the decisive great war of Armageddon will occur. And the Christians today believe, Christian fundamentalists, that this battle of Armageddon, which will occur in this land of Palestine, will occur with, some have claimed, 400 million soldiers. And they believe what was going to happen is this, that the Christians, that the Muslims will attack the Jews in Israel, and as a result, the battle will pursue, and Jesus will come down to save his people, the Jews. And so what he will do is he'll take the Christians up into the clouds, which is what they call the rapture, and then the Christians, those who will remain before he takes them up the clouds, they will send their nuclear bombs upon the Muslims and destroy them. And for this reason, one author has written in a book describing this Christian viewpoint, the Christian fundamentalist, she says, and I'm quoting, "Convinced that a nuclear Armageddon is an inevitable event within the divine scheme of things, many evangelical dispensationalism is a type of Christian creed, have committed themselves to a course for Israel that, by their own admission, will lead directly to a Holocaust indescribably more savage and widespread than any vision of carnage that could have been generated in Adolf Hitler's criminal mind." And there are many books of this. One of the most popular books concerning the subject was a book that appeared in the 70s. And this book sold 19 million copies in the 70s. And it was by an author called Hal Lindsey. And it was called The Late Great Planet Earth. And in this book, which you find in every single airport in the world, you find that it describes in a dramatic fashion the coming of the end of the world and the battle of Armageddon. And what will happen? He gives you an image of what's going to happen. Recently, the same individual, Hal Lindsey, and I forgot to bring the book with me, but I'll bring it tomorrow, inshallah, has written another book. Came out this year or the year before. Together with you?
No.
And it's called The Final Battle, where he gives you on the cover a picture of a mushroom cloud, nuclear mushroom cloud. And you might imagine who that cloud has fallen upon, that nuclear bomb has been rained upon, the Muslims. And that is because the Christians will believe that the Battle of Armageddon will conclude with a total victory for the Christians and a complete destruction of the idolaters, that is the Muslims. And that this will occur when the Christians with the Messiah are raised above the clouds, and the Muslims will then drown, according to Revelation 19:20, when it said, a lake of fire burning with brimstone. They say this lake of fire burning with brimstone is the nuclear bomb which we will...